Are you feeling burnt out, overwhelmed, like you're just an Uber driver to your kids' endless appointments? Do you wonder, is this all there is? Stop driving around and try something different. Book in with Body and Mind Online for expert speech therapy, occupational therapy, psychologist and counsellors via telehealth. I founded Body and Mind Online 5 years ago, and it has since been one of the most inclusive therapy centres in the country. This podcast is my passion project. But I've realized that by not openly recommending Body and Mind Online, I'm leaving many of you to navigate the daunting task of finding the right providers on your own. Stop the struggle and get the support that you and your family deserve. Visit adhdmums.com.au and visit the therapy page to take the first step forward towards a balanced life with Body and Mind Online. Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life. This is a double episode week. Ta-da! And I'm back with a solo episode. I wanted to talk about one thing that I get asked so often, and it's how do you pick the right practitioner? What makes a great practitioner? Who do I pick? Who do I recommend for an assessment? And it is such a challenging topic. So I thought I'd create an episode about what to look for to ensure that you can find the right practitioner. One of the episodes that I released a while ago, episode 3, my top takeaways from the past year, I talked at length about how incredible it was for us to receive support and help from a parenting psychologist, which drastically changed the trajectory of our family. And I've received so many messages since then. I really wanted to talk to you about what I look for in a practitioner. I also detailed in that episode that a quality practitioner is worth the wait, and finding the right person is so much more important. When I acted quickly just to plug a hole or fill a gap, I noticed that the practitioner seemed to leave quite quickly. And that was a nightmare, because not only is it the initial appointment where you have to go through everything and get to know everybody, but it's also another person in your child's life that they've met, build a rapport with, that disappears for them. This episode is just going to go into what to do, how to source them, where to start. First off, my Facebook group. It is cranking. I have got an assessment chat, which is where everyone can chat about assessments just generally, nationally, telehealth providers, the whole shebang in the Facebook group. It's in the show notes. Also, there's meetups locally. You don't have to meet up, right? But you can go into the group and ask locally where people have been. If you tag me, I will respond. My ADHD is rampant in there, and my need to achieve and perfectionism. If you tag me, I'd be shocked if I don't answer. I think I've answered every individual tag at 100% rate at this point. God help me. So before we jump into 6 questions to ask a practitioner, to see if they're the right one for you that I would always ask, let's take a brief step back, have a look at the overview for just a moment. We have come such a long way in terms of understanding the way that people think, interact, and experience the world differently. In the past, autistic people, people with ADHD, and other profiles were just categorized with what they can't do. One of my biggest bugbears with the NDIS is it's deficit-based. What can't your kid do? Also, pet hate inclusion meetings at a school where all they talk about is what your kid can't do. Well, hang on a second. What does my kid bring that's great? What do they do in that classroom that no one else does? One of my kids cleans up the classroom like a cleaner. Trust me, they don't do it at my house. But productivity and seeking positive reinforcement. And they are often a leader in following the rules and reminding people of the rules. And it's probably a problem socially. But I tell you what, they're basically a teacher's aide. So yeah, I'd like some positive reinforcement about what my child is doing. That's awesome. Could you imagine going to marriage counseling or having a chat with a friend and not giving them the shit sandwich with something good they're doing, something they need to improve on, and something good after? Could you imagine if that was the way you were performance managed, or that was the way that you were in a relationship where all they did was talk about what you weren't doing well? I don't understand how we keep doing it. And feel free to stand up for your child. There's nothing wrong with starting an inclusion meeting. And if they start going deficit-based, what your kid can't do, there's nothing wrong with saying, I'd just like to acknowledge for a moment how far my child's come, the really positive contribution he has had in the classroom. There's nothing wrong with starting it, because I tell you what, it sets the tone for the meeting. We have got the National Autism Strategy that has been released, and it is looking at neurodiversity and neuroaffirming care and practice. You might have heard all about this, but what does it mean? It challenges the traditional medical model of disability. That model views neurological differences solely through the lens of deficits and disorders that should be just treated and cured. We don't want to see our child or ourselves as something that needs to be treated or cured. We want to reframe neurodiversity to be different, equally valuable, and a way of experiencing and navigating the world. We see all the time that there's all these geniuses that were actually autistic or had ADHD, and that's all coming out now. We know that they're the groundbreakers. We know that they're innovative. We know that they take risks. So they are just as important as everybody else. And I think that's coming now. If you're wondering what neurotypical is, a lot of people say that nobody is neurotypical. There is no typical brain. We are all different. It's a really evolving landscape language, and we are going to come back around to that. The term neurodivergent applies to autistic people, those with ADHD, dyslexia, other profiles. There's professionals out there who believe that if we put depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, all of the acronyms into one big pot, it would be 50% of the population. Neuroaffirming care can take many forms depending on the person's need and context. It involves accepting, valuing all the different ways of thinking, learning, and experiencing the world. Rather than fixing or changing the neurodivergent people or forcing them to fit into some tiny, narrow idea of what is considered normal or better, neuroaffirming care takes a person-centered, strength-based approach. It empowers and supports unique needs and strengths. Now, for me, reading that, it seems like a mouthful, but this is why, if you strip that back, this is where we end up as mums being the advocate and we end up walking the talk, because I won't allow somebody in my presence to speak in a way that makes it out that my kids or myself or someone that I know or just generally neurodivergent people have something wrong with them. And I'm air quoting wrong with them. So I try to do it kindly, but let me give you an example. Someone that I worked with recently said, oh yes, this person is going to be doing this and they have autism. Now, that's kind of like saying that they have cancer. That sounds like a really bad diagnosis that somebody needs help with. And I just really gently said, hey, you know, probably better off saying that they're autistic. And the person said that they didn't even notice the difference. And actually, to be fair, I didn't either until it was pointed out to me in one of my episodes. And if you look all the way back, you'll see that there is references that are incorrect in regards to autistic and ADHD people. This is not in a derogatory way, it's just in a learning way. And I've done it myself. So I generally try and give people a bit of a break that at least they are understanding and repeating information and talking about it, because that's breaking the stigma. When we're not talking about it, that we're there, I think is the problem. I think we're better off encouraging people to talk about it incorrectly and then helping them understand, rather than scaring people off and then they don't want to say anything again for fear of getting it wrong. So what would be the difference? What is the right model of care? I would say it's a social model of disability, with neuroaffirming care acknowledging that there is often disability associated from being different. We know that this world is not designed for neurodivergent people. There's a shift focusing away from the person having to adapt to the environment and mask, camouflage, fit in, or receive therapy on how to be more neurotypical, and more of a push around changing the world or the environment, the sporting team, the school, the workplace to fit the individual. Or if it's true that there's 50% of the population are neurodivergent now, then why would we continue to hold up the same framework of the world and have those people suffer from low self-esteem and all of the other mental health conditions, right? Like the anxiety, depression. Okay, let's just pop that aside. In terms of Australia, why would we spend more money on prisons, Centrelink, alcohol and drug centres, when we could proactively get ahead of it and help these people earlier? There's a lot of research coming out now that alcohol and drug abuse, for example, is sometimes a neurodivergent person self-medicating their symptoms. So why would we spend more money on drug and alcohol centers later as they're an adult and try to help them, rather than getting ahead and helping them contribute to the world now. I know people who've been to prison, a lot of people haven't positively reflected on the rehabilitation program, let's put it that way. But the NDIS is actually helping people contribute to Australia. So if we're putting in resources to help people to contribute, to help them live independently, to help them work, where's the problem? Because I'm looking at it like, well, that there would eventually offset prison and drug and alcohol, eating disorder clinics. There is so much neurodivergence within that space. I'm going to grab the research and put it into the show note. Saw and I read that in the US, they are assessing people going into the prison system and they are finding that 1 in 3 are neurodivergent. And it's drastically changing their outcomes rehabilitation-wise. We also know in eating disorder clinics that that is clearly the case as well. So we know that a lot of the people in eating disorder clinics are born female. And I'm not across the right gender language. So I'm just going to declare that now. I'm going to do my best, but I'm so in the disability space and I've got 3 kids. I do my best. So I'm not fully across all of the wording for gender, but we do know that most of them identify with female at birth and I'll refer to them as female just for the moment. So if we know that there's a lot of females in there and they're also autistic, we know that their therapy needs to be different. So what if we jumped in early to some of these autistic girls? So the point that I'm making is I don't understand why we are not changing the world to fit with the population, especially if that neurodivergent bucket is becoming larger. What if we focused on thriving? So how about we shift the view for those kids and we start to look at what they do well and pushing them towards those areas? How about we make accommodations and adaptions and make life more accessible? How about we allow them to thrive? Because if we're only catering to half of the population, don't we need people to work? Don't we want people to contribute? There's a lot of people talking about the NDIS and their taxes. That's what we're doing. We're actually proactively getting ahead. This is why putting those funds in for capacity building for small children early before they're 12 and their brain is developing is so important. That's what we're doing it for. Neuroaffirming practitioners really means that a therapist has an understanding of the neurodivergent culture, how positive social identity can impact self-esteem and well-being. The therapist makes efforts to bridge the gap in communication. So for example, a lot of people understand the double empathy problem. I told myself this was going to be a 10-minute episode and look at me go. I haven't even gotten to where I'm going yet. So the double empathy problem is that often neurotypical people, and I know I said before, neurotypical people don't exist because everyone has a unique brain. It's hard to know with terminology as to what to use at times. So let's call them neurotypical for a moment. So we know that neurotypical people are going to struggle to communicate with people that are neurodivergent, for example, you know, autistic ADHD, just as an example. So autistic and ADHD people have no issues communicating. They can communicate fine with each other. Neurotypical people can communicate fine too with each other. But the medical model of disability holds up the neurotypical way of communicating and says that this is what you're supposed to do. So you neurodivergent people, can you just learn how to do this? Because this is how you're supposed to speak. But a neurotypical therapist should be bridging the gap for the client. If the client is autistic or ADHD and they have a way that they like to communicate, the standard is not that that person, the child, the patient, then changes their communication so the neurotypical person finds it easier. The neurotypical person needs to meet that person where they're at. So neuroaffirming therapy is really about the therapist or the practitioner tuning into the child, into their preferred way of communicating, playing, engaging. This brings meaningful connection for the patient or the child, not just compliance that they have to teach the neurotypical way of playing or relating or teach them how to play Barbie because that's what kids do. It may not be about that for their child. And it's not about teaching them what they should, could be doing. It's about meeting them where they're at. So the National Autism Strategy is really about promoting awareness that our population is neurodiverse and it hopes to get the world and Australia predominantly to be more inclusive and understanding. So, parenting. I never thought I would consider myself a disability advocate, ever. A friend said to me the other day that they were really proud that I'd stepped into the disability advocate space. And I actually was like a bit weirded out by the whole comment, mainly because it hasn't felt like a choice. And I know that I've told this story before, so I'm not going to go into detail for it. It's in so many of my other episodes. When my daughter hit grade two, which was like 18 months ago, she was put in a high needs class with all kinds of externalizing children. And if you want to know what externalizing is, it's pretty simple. Externalizing just means that you externalize your behavior. You might see children that hit other kids or hit themselves or punch the wall or run away or clearly need help. And my daughter's an internalizer. And so she was put in a high needs classroom, two different teachers. One of them was about to retire. She was very tired and old and grumpy. And the other one was just off maternity leave. I think she had postnatal depression. What happened was my daughter didn't cope with the noise, the volume, the chaos. And I don't think that the classroom was well managed. There was a lot of kids that left that class that year. And I complained outwardly, assertively, over and over. I put in three allied health letters of diagnosis. So it was all a big, big storm. We only saw it at home. I would put her in the car in the afternoon and she would just start screaming. She was tearing her hair out. She was picking at her legs. She was refusing to eat, losing weight. And when I went to the school about it repeatedly, they told me there was nothing wrong with her and there was something wrong with me. I've got that in writing over and over again, that principal in a public school on the Sunshine Coast. And before you say, oh, you should have put a complaint in, I went to put a complaint in and then a few people warned me that she had friends in the education office. So there was no point. However, I have told every single person in the whole world about that story. So at that point, I changed my children's school and it became very clear to me that my expectation that people knew or could understand her was not going to happen. It was very clear. I even offered to pay for a clinical psychologist to attend the school to run staff training. I attempted to pay a specialist advocate to go into the classroom and see if it was a safe environment for my child, which was all rejected. So I don't feel like I'm in this space out of choice. I'm naturally a very private person. I'm in this space because I have to be. You don't have to be as public as I am, but we do end up advocating for our children. And this is how we make change. I also want to choose really respectful language, whatever the diagnoses are that your child has. So we want to validate their experience and I don't want to hear all the things that are wrong with them. And if you have an internalizer child, and I have two, a boy and a girl. So when I say girls are internalizers, yes, I have a boy internalizer too. They internalize the brokenness and I am air quoting brokenness. Because if we continue to talk about neurodivergent children as kids that need to be fixed, sorted out, trained, therapied, they will start to feel that brokenness and it will be reinforced each time they encounter the language. I don't want my children to hate ADHD. So I want to go through some language nuances. We want to use people-centered language, which is, for example, Sarah identifies as autistic rather than Sarah was diagnosed with autism, which sounds freakishly like Sarah was diagnosed with cancer. Sarah does not have autism. She didn't get it from anywhere. She didn't catch it. It's a autistic neurotype that was always present, but took time to be identified. A little bit like right-handed, left-handed. You're born that way, but it kind of takes a while for you to figure out what hand you like to use. So we're really moving away from that medical model where we're not diagnosing autism and cancer together. We're talking about a difference rather than a disorder. We're not referring to children as needing treatments or interventions. We're talking about support services, respectful therapy, education strategies, and unconditional love. We're not talking about special needs. We're talking about individual needs because every child has individual needs, whether they're neurodivergent or not. The other thing as well is there's a movement away from low functioning and high functioning. I spoke to someone about this yesterday, actually. They were talking about how their child has this complete anxiety episode every 6 to 8 weeks. And why could they go to school one day and they can't the next day? And I talk to them about how sometimes I have something really simple to do and it's really easy and I don't need any help. And then 6 weeks later, I have the same task, and depending on what kind of build-ups there and environment and my level of fatigue and what's happening for me, it's like near impossible. So when we're labeling something as low needs, high needs, we have to remember that everybody's having a bad day and a good day. And just because someone does something one day doesn't mean they can do it the next. And I think this is sometimes the way with the NDIS. We've got to be really careful about going, oh, that person's high functioning, so they're fine. And that person is low functioning, so they need lots of help. So we're moving towards more like support needs, as opposed to whether labeling someone as high functioning or low functioning. For example, a lot of people talk about high functioning anxiety. I've done it in the past. I'll probably still continue to do it, but it's an example, right? So some people have said to me, oh, I have high functioning anxiety. And I actually say to them now, do you really have high functioning anxiety, or do you just not ask for help? Because my question would be, is the anxiety level the same as somebody who needs a lot of help, but you've learned over time not to ask for help, or that's your family upbringing? And why should you deserve less help just because you ask for help less? That's an example of the schooling system too. So if you have a child that's labeled as high functioning and you've got a child that's labeled as low functioning, you've got a child that's not asking for help, but they're internalizing and their soul is crushing inside. Or you've got a child that's maybe they're doing things to be disruptive because they know they get to go for a walk and they get to leave the classroom. Why should one leave the classroom and one not? So when we talk about high functioning, low functioning, we do want to have a bit of a think about that. I have high functioning anxiety, that's for sure. I don't ask for help very often or ever. But does that mean that I don't need help? No, it just means that I suffer silently a lot of the time and push myself to continue no matter what. So it's really important that we start to learn neuroaffirming language, because if we can start to educate others kindly in the way that we want our child or ourselves to be referred to, language is everything, and it changes the way that things are viewed, which is why I think if we can create change, particularly with teachers, and I actually haven't met a teacher that I don't believe had their heart in the right place or wasn't trying their best. I believe the education system is completely broken, which is a whole nother thing. But I believe that all schools could do it if they had a smaller ratio or they had more resources. But there's a movement away from autism spectrum disorder, and it's a movement into autism spectrum difference, or just simply autism. We know that the name ADHD has to change. We know that. Who is going to change that and how that's going to happen, I have no idea. But it does make it really tricky with language, because if we're saying Sarah is autistic and has ADHD, you're still using that and has, and then putting a disorder in it, even though you're using the autistic word differently. It's really difficult for me to write any resources, actually, because I'm constantly saying Jane has ADHD, but I don't want to say Sarah has autism. So I don't want to say, I kind of have to say Sarah is autistic and has ADHD, but I can't say Sarah has autism and ADHD, because that's incorrectly using the word autism. So it is tricky, and we can't get it right all the time. So you might be thinking, this isn't important. Why are words important? Words are really important because they're what your child is hearing, and that's where their self-esteem is going to come in. If your child is newly diagnosed, it's really important to remember that your child is the same child that they've always been. So if you're now thinking to yourself, well, how can I possibly parent this autistic child? Just remember that you've always actually done that. They were born that way. They've always been that way. And if you've just found out, they're still your child. They're actually no different. So in some ways, nothing's changed, except you have more resources and help than before. If you're looking to have resources, I would first off go to lived experience. I don't know why so many practitioners have got an issue with TikTok and Instagram. Yeah, there's a lot of information on there that isn't correct. I agree. However, just look up the credentials of the people that you're following, because if you're following a practitioner that's educated, that's also got lived experience, and they're sharing their experience, it might be really relevant to you. Just check the validity of the information. But I actually think that that's the best information to get is those lived experiences, social media experiences. If you're only getting information from practitioners that haven't necessarily done professional development, you might be getting really old information. You might be thinking that this sounds like a lot of work. Okay, the more that we learn, the more empowered we are to inform our decisions, educate others, and advocate for your child. We can't learn everything all at once. However, you will save time if you do some research. Okay, so back to the topic. 6 ways to check whether a practitioner is neuroaffirming. Let's quickly touch on the risks. Be aware of applied behavior analysis. I've talked about it before, ABA. They generally come under the NDIS positive behavior support system. That's where they seem to live mostly, probably because of the pay rate at that level is very high. Someone that's sitting in that space is not necessarily qualified. They might have just got out of uni. They might have just like graduated from social work or another allied health speechy, possibly. They may not have kids either. Be aware. Personally, I would pretty much never get a practitioner that hasn't had kids. Even if they love kids, that's nice, but you don't really get it. We also want to be aware of people saying they're going to fix people, they're going to fix kids, and they're going to improve them to make neurotypical, or they're going to train them like dogs, like positive and negative reinforcement. You know, like you give the dog a treat if they do the right thing. Children are not animals. And we also need to be aware of in this process, when we're actually actively trying to help and support our child, we're building up their self-esteem. We're not focusing on what they can't do and then continuing to hold up this reward until they do it and then they can't do it and we punish them. If you're working on a skill with your child and they're still not able to do it, you might want to have a look at firstly, like, is it developmentally appropriate? Have you really taught them how to do it? Is it broken down enough? Is there visual aids? I don't think we can then just go back to, okay, well, that child's really naughty because that child won't do what they're told. I think we want to have a look at what they can do first and figure out the environment around them. If you're looking at PBS, I'm going to put in the show notes the positive behavior support episode I did with Renee De La Cruz. Incredible. If you'd like to know more about PBS, she's an incredible PBS provider. Okay, this is just a quick list, right? Firstly, what professional development or self-directed study have you done to update your knowledge on ADHD, autistic, trauma, whatever it is that your child or you are working on yourself? What you're looking for here is that things have moved a lot in the last 20 years. If they list a university degree that they did 20 years ago as their only source of new information, red flag. If they say, oh, I've got my social work degree from 2001, that's okay. What have you done since? Do you do professional development? If so, where? Who provided the training? And did you go looking for this information yourself? Or how have you done that? If they say they've got like lifelong learning, I've just been doing this for 20 years, so I just know what I'm doing. It's a gray area. I'd move on and see how they go. You could ask who they primarily work with and what they've learnt. Is there anything they don't do now that they used to do? Like ask some questions, or are they just literally hammering the same knowledge from 20 years ago? I would then ask, is your practice ADHD or neurodivergent friendly? So for example, do they offer telehealth as well as in person? Do they have sensory tools? Are there videos that are captioned? Is there good parking? Can I make appointments online? What tax is this going to be on me as the parent? That's a really good question, because if you're going to get hit with hour-long initials, catch-up phone calls, lots of extra paperwork, you want to know. Some practitioners, I believe, do that. Well, I think it's a bit of an NDIS funds thing where they go a bit above and beyond. That's okay, but I'm always very careful of my time. So I'm going to send you the recurrent reports for my children. You're going to read them. And that's going to be your initial. And if you have any questions, then you need to write them down and email them to me and I will respond. I'm not sitting on the phone with you and talking to you about how long my pregnancy was and what the developmental milestones were for that child that I've already done 6 times that are in all of the reports. You can read it. If I get kickback on that, I don't move forward. Reason being is because I just don't think they're progressive enough or flexible enough or individualized enough. And if they can't figure that part out, I just don't understand how they can figure out anything else that I'm going to give them. I also ask, how would you describe, and then put your child's diagnosis in there and get them to tell you what they think it is. The words that they use, and we've gone over language, is going to tell you a lot. If they go over what that person can't do, what they're going to do to fix them, that would be a red flag for me and I would be finishing up. Often I do this on the phone and I refuse to go to the office because it's a waste of time if they're going to start talking about my child like a small dog. I don't need to be there for that and I don't want to then feel like I have to fulfill the next 45 minutes knowing that I'm never going to use this person. I also then ask, how do you individualize your approach to your client's mental health care? What you're looking for there is you're looking for somebody to agree with you that it's all individualized. If you get somebody with a generic plan, that is a red flag. A generic plan can be modeled and individualized for somebody. And I understand that that's probably, if you've got a good therapy model, maybe you do replicate it across clients, especially if it works. And I think that's great. However, if they do like to work that way, that's okay. But I will be asking questions about, are you going to find out my child's sensory profile? Are you going to make any accommodations? Also, I've been caught out many times in reception areas or car parks with some very tricky, dangerous situations. I'm hoping, touch wood, those times have passed, but I usually ask, if I give reception a call, is someone able to come down and help me if I need it? Or if I have a critical situation upstairs or downstairs in this office, is there somebody that's able to come and help me? I also ask about language. I always say, how do you like to start off the sessions? Or what kind of things do you do in the session? I also usually ask questions around what they're interested in because I usually say to them it's best to connect with my kids on something that they're interested in. So for example, my daughter was like really into knitting for a while, like finger puppets and knitting. And I was like, have you ever knitted before? Do you know all the different types of wool? Can you just talk about that? So sometimes I find practitioners to be so professional that they will not disclose anything about themselves at all. And it's like, at some point, you're going to have to actually give something because otherwise it's just like you're a mirror reflecting questions back. Also, do you work with triggers? Do you identify triggers? Will you get to know and leverage strengths and passions? So we know that an ADHD child or person's strengths can boost self-esteem. And it's a key component of the neuroaffirming approach to mental health care. If you're experiencing high levels of stress and anxiety, engaging in your interests is pretty much the most effective coping strategy. And that really needs to be encouraged. So if you have a practitioner that, for example, your child is really into art and they just keep talking about expanding their horizons and doing something different and not playing with their one friend and trying to make other friends, okay, that's probably a bit much. Because if my child just wants to do art all the time, how about asking her about it? That might be a great way to connect rather than discouraging her from the only thing that she likes doing. Also, I do like to stay away from adverse childhood experiences if I can, mainly because, for example, if you have a socially anxious child, it may be more helpful to go through situations that are happening right now and identify practical coping strategies right now. Rather than go back into 2 years ago, this child laughed at me when I was eating my lunch, so now I can't eat lunch in front of everybody again. That just starts to have an expiry date on it. I don't see it moving forward, personally, in my experience. But I do find it helpful to talk about practical strategies about where the child could sit that they would feel comfortable. How could they make sure they eat lunch and they have the energy levels that they need in this different experience that they're in now? If we continually go back to the why, it has an expiry date. There's a time for that, but there's also a time just to move forward. We are doing our best as parents, but I also think we want to make sure that if we are Ubering our child around, paying a lot of money, doing the wait list, finding the sources, and physically getting our child in front of somebody, I want that to be quality. And for me, neuroaffirming training is quality. One pet hate of mine is that I feel like a lot of people are now saying that they're neuroaffirming. And are they, or is that just a label that they're putting on because they would like to access NDIS funds? And that I have a problem with. Similar, there's a lot of people that have been in this mental health space for a long time who in the last few months are coming out into the NDIS space. Is that because the general population have got less money to spend on other services and they're going to where the NDIS funds are? That's okay. Everyone has to run the business, but I think that we need to make sure that people really are neuroaffirming rather than just saying they are. Reading a document on Google and saying that you're a neuroaffirming practitioner is not neuroaffirming practitioners. And ADHD Mums has been a huge passion project of mine. The episodes have really been a labor of love the last 18 months. I rarely talk about the mental health company that I founded and built back in 2019. However, I think the amount of DMs that I receive and the Facebook group around where are the right practitioners, who can help me, I need an OT, I need a speechy, I can't get in anywhere, have begun to really pile up. And at some point I've looked at it like, when does it become a disservice to not recommend a place that I know works? For me, a founder of a large psychology company in this space, I have myself personally checked that every practitioner that works in this space has got neuroaffirming training, because that's the strong belief that I have. And I've insisted on that. Body & Mind Online has got telehealth options. It's got zero wait lists. Each practitioner is neuroaffirming trained. And sharing that resource as a way to access the best quality care is something that I feel like at this point I should do, especially when I hear such horror stories elsewhere. The Facebook group is brilliant. However, nothing can really surpass that individualized care. And we've just talked about how every program needs to be different and how every person is different. Every brain is different. Every family situation is different. What works for me may not work for you. So there's really nothing that you can substitute for individualized care. Body & Mind has got psychologists, counselors, positive behavioral therapists, speech therapists, OTs. It's got the works. And it works across telehealth predominantly, but it also can work in physical locations depending on where you are. So it's always worth putting your details in, finding out where it is. I've got a services page listed in the show notes. If you'd like to click on it or go on my website under services, you can put your details in. By putting your details in, you will get an email with all of the logistical information, including price availability in your area. And then you can schedule a call as an NDIS person with an NDIS plan, or your children have got NDIS plans, or as a Medicare private patient. If you don't have access to NDIS yet, put the private patient just to begin with. And this is not one of those things where the Medicare patients don't get seen or prioritized. I've had a look at the rates. I think they're very affordable, and I think they're way underneath what other companies are charging. Hands down, there is private healthcare rebates as well. If you're not sure, pop your details in and have a chat with them. It's a no obligation phone call. I used Ease myself, and that was one of the reasons that I wanted to bring it up, was because I thought to myself, geez, I have access to this so easily. It seems unfair that no one else does. The other thing that I've made available to you that I don't think anyone else has is I've spoken to the team about the level of burnout, stress, anxiety, and depression that we as parents and mums are going through. Tony Atwood said in one of his episodes here that the biggest change he wanted to see was supports for the mum. And the level of stress and pressure that we are under is enormous. We have everyday mums who classify themselves as neurotypical with neurotypical children. And they are saying that they are burnout, tired, stressed. Okay, well, add some neurological conditions in there and see how you go. Add in children that are 30% delayed in what they should, air quoting, what they should be doing. For example, my 5.5-year-old, I'm still toilet training him. So I'm coming up 9 years of toilet training. Like, I've been wiping up poo for 9 years straight. My belief is that if you are talking about your child and you are talking about parenting your child, how to be better for them, how to control your anxiety and stress, how to get more executive function so you can remember the library book, the homework, and you can be there for them completely. That's where the NDIS needs to come in as well. So if your child has an NDIS plan, you can book in, and whether your child there is there or not, if you're talking about your child, you're educating yourself, you're receiving help that's related to your child's diagnosis, then that will be billed under your NDIS plan. And I don't believe that anybody else in this country is doing that. If you're screaming out for help, that's available to you. If you want to have your child come into the session for 5-10 minutes, and if they're engaged for 5 or 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it is, and they're having that time, great. Maybe it works better for you, for your child to have a shorter session and then for you to speak about your child afterwards. Maybe it's better to remove him from the room. I know I've talked about iPad use not being great, but perhaps you do put some headphones on that child. You do have them watch a movie. You do go to another room and you do talk about how that session went for them and how you can implement it. There's so much flexibility within this company that I have specifically asked for. So whether you have that session while your child's at school, whether you have that session in the evening or in the afternoon is up to you. Whether you split that, it's up to you. Whether you do that as part of an education piece for your partner who's not understanding it, power to you. If you want to tackle whether you should time out your child or not, and you need to talk that through with somebody, that would be going through on the NDIS depending on your plan. Again, if you're in a Medicare and you're a private client, that would be the same. Yes, there'd be an out-of-pocket. However, if your mental health plan has finished, right, and you've already had your sessions for the year, maybe your child needs to have a mental health care plan, and then maybe you're able to access that person through that on that Medicare rebate. There's so many ways to flexibly do it. My core that I believe is that majority of the therapy sessions that I have for the last 5 years has been about my children. I very rarely have anything that's specific to me, because they are the biggest source of stress that I have and that I want to be better for them. So there's so much flexibility within this. If you have a child that you don't feel could have a therapy session mobile, or you don't want to drive them around, that's okay, because you can have the session with them, or maybe you upskill yourself. For example, I've been trying to get my kids to sit at the table to have dinner, but I'm very confused. And that's only once a week, by the way. But it's confusing as to what to do if they won't eat the food, what to do if they run away. I want to have the confidence that I have a mental health professional telling me that this is the boundary to hold. So for me, it's about confidence. It's about holding that boundary. So if you want to run through any of those scenarios with someone qualified, that's another great outcome. I've spoken a lot about parenting psychologists and the good that they can give you. I don't believe dropping your child off like a bag of potatoes at a therapy session and going hands off is going to really create a lot of change. So I'd rather have a session about what's going on than pick up that child from a waiting room because I've got the other two in the car and not know what's going on there. Because there has to be that consistent approach at home. For example, if I drop one of my kids off to work on emotional regulation, so what the psychologist does is he amps them all the way up and then he brings them all the way down and teaches them how to calm down. If I don't know what the strategy is, how are they going to improve? So that would be one of the biggest things for me, is to really get in there into what I'm doing at home and how I can connect more with my child. Connection first is so important, and having an understanding of them and where they're coming from. I'm sure this is an example that everyone's thought of, where you think that you know what's happened. You've seen someone fly off the handle. You've seen somebody hit somebody, and you've gone in to talk to the child that you think is the culprit. But after you've cooled down, you've realized, and they've started to speak, that there was actually an instigator before that. But if you go straight into punishment or what you think is the best way forward and not having that connection piece, you may find that you've actually got it wrong, even though it looks obvious. It's happened to me a number of times, and now I always stop and take a breath, because it looks pretty obvious, but is it really? I also had a situation recently where my middle son has been belting my little one, and it was really upsetting to see, because I've got a nearly 7-year-old, really physically attacking a five-year-old, and I'm assuming it's a seven-year-old's fault. When I stripped it back with a parenting psychologist recently, what they actually uncovered was that actually my little one makes a lot of noise. And so, for example, if they're playing a game and he gets really excited, my littlest one will start yelling and screaming very loudly. It is really irritating. And my middle son has an idea in his mind. He just wants to shut them up, air quoting. And so he will belt him in the face to stop him from making noise, because in his mind, it's so grating on his sensory and his senses. He cannot deal with the loud noise and he'll do anything to stop it. So teaching him to walk outside and teaching him other strategies to get away has been really tricky. But I was trying to understand why he kept doing it. And until I really unpacked that with a psychologist, I absolutely had no way of figuring out what that was. And that has drastically changed my two boys' relationship, my relationship with him, and all of our family unit understanding what his sensory preferences are. So I'm very passionate about finding the right care because I work in mental health care. I also have seen the huge progress my kids have made. I've very publicly talked about my daughter's difficulty with school. Wow, she's had a massive turnaround in the last 6 months. And that hasn't been sitting at home. That has been actively going to therapists, actively finding help, actively figuring it out, and then reintegrating her back into mainstream school. So this episode is really about connecting you with the care that I found and what works for me and allowing you the opportunity to book in with the same people. I highly encourage you to give it a go. Thank you for listening. I hope you got something out of this very brief 10-minute episode. I've just looked at the time and I'm a little mortified because I thought I couldn't talk for 10 minutes, but look at me go.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.